Hey, what's up, guys? It's John here from the REI Contractor Show. I have a special guest on today, and I'm looking forward to this conversation that I have 12 times a day. This is Scott Zandbergen. Scott Zandbergen is a real estate investor. He's got quite the portfolio. I'll let him tell you about that. Scott and I have been working together for a few years now.
Yeah.
He's one of my favorite yet pain in the ass clients.
In terms of endearment,
exactly. When he calls, you said, I'd like to duplex my house for 25 grand. And this is why you have to have a good relationship. So you can tell him that's not going to happen. But thanks for being on, Scott. I appreciate your time for the third time today. And so introduce yourself.
Well, thank you for having me. I don't think I spoke to you three times today. I think it's maybe twice. So actually, this is the third time. You're right. So my name is Scott Zandbergen. Like John, I'm a fellow Dutchman, which means we are... We tend to agree on things like being frugal, i.e. cheap. Let's see. So I've been doing buying real estate investment properties since about early 2014. Took the plunge and haven't looked back. So just kept on growing the portfolio and having a lot of fun along the way. So let's see. I started in 2014. I left my corporate job in 2020. So just at the very beginning of when this whole COVID fun stuff happened.
Worst decision ever.
No. It's been a great decision. So John only says that because why? Now I can't
buy more. You can't buy more duplexes.
Yeah, that's just a temporary problem. We'll solve that eventually. So, So for now, getting mortgages is a little challenging, but that's not going to slow me down from still doing projects and doing acquisitions and maybe some more flips, things like that. So that's what we're working on. But
yeah, beautiful.
Yeah.
So Scott, how many properties do you have now?
So I'm sitting on, I think 11 right now. So we were just chatting beforehand, and I actually sold a few over the last little while. So when I started investing, I focused on buying single family homes because they were the easiest, and that's where a lot of people start. And you know, you get one tenant in there, and the tenant takes care of all the utilities. You never hear from them. They treat the house like it's their own. And so did that and held several properties that were single family homes for 5 years. And at the end of that 5-year term, right when the mortgage renewals were all coming due, you know, I took a look at what those properties were worth in the market and was pleasantly surprised that they had grown substantially in value. And so I sold them because in parallel, I had started doing some duplex work in around 2017, I think it was, when we first started doing the duplexing. And so when the opportunity came up to get rid of the single family homes, it was like another injection of capital that I could use to move the duplex projects that much faster along. So anyways, got rid of those single family homes. And now I'm just sitting on duplexes. There's one that has potential to be working on right now. It could be a triplex. We're just going through the designs right now. So whether it lands at a triplex or a duplex still remains to be seen. It could even be a fourplex if we got really creative. So lots on the go.
Well, let's tell the truth about that one now. So we've been working together on this one for about 2 months, and we've changed the design about what, 6 times. And
Okay. So you do like to exaggerate like me a little bit, I see. So it was just over a month. We closed on that property a month ago, and so this was when we bought wholesale. It's a big house. It's a 2.5-story on the Hamilton Mountain, and lots of square footage, and you know, there's room for a third unit right in the loft or the attic of this place. And so that's why we were thinking of maybe doing it as a triplex, but there's just been a lot of a little curveballs thrown at us as we've been going through the design process. You know, we realized that, well, it's zoned right now for up to 2 units. So that's the way we can get it through done quickly with the city, get it permitted. If we want to add the third unit, we have to go through a rezoning process, which, you know, it's not impossible. It just takes time. And the design people are telling me right now to set my expectations that it could take up to a year to get the permitting approved for third unit. And then if you go down the path of adding a fourth unit, then then it could trigger other expenses. And anyways, it's just, it's getting a little bit scary, but we'll figure it out.
Fair enough. Yeah, no, we're recording this in August 2020, yeah. The most interesting year in real estate history.
And, it has been a fun one.
The honest truth of the matter is that all the cities right now are majorly backed up or not working at full capacity. I have some duplex permits that should be normally 3 to 4 weeks tops. We're sitting at 8, 9, 10 weeks, and we still don't have permits from the city. So,
it's painful, especially when you're, sorry to cut you off, but just,
oh, it's all right.
It's fresh in my mind here, right? Because so on this one specifically, so it's been 5 weeks now, almost six since we bought it. And we bought it with using private funds, right? So we have a private lender that put the first mortgage on the place. And, you know, that's not insignificant when you're looking at the amount of interest you're paying, right? So every month you have to hold the property is like an extra, you know, big interest payment you have to make. So it lights a fire under your butt, right? To kind of keep things going. And when you're sitting on the sidelines, just waiting for the city to give you a permit, or in our case, to get designs submitted. So we're still working through that process. It's just, it gets a little bit, it just creates some anxiety, let's say.
Yeah, fair enough. Mm-hmm. On that note, I mean, as a contractor, these permits, we never really wait to start. There is a limitation to what we can do, but I'm a firm believer that once the drawings have been submitted to the city, you can get the ball rolling, get the place cleaned out. Like typically I'll start the framing once the drawings are in the city. I'll start some rough-ins, and then we usually have the permit by then, or we're gonna have to wait. Like currently right now I have one project that we're completely roughed in. I can't go any further, but it's just interesting times we live in. What are we going to do about it, right? So all we can do is do our best. But as an investor, when you're analyzing all this, it's certainly would be disconcerting.
Yeah. It just adds to what is already, you know, being an investor can be a little stressful at times. Like when you get a lot of moving parts and you're relying on lots of people to get lots of pieces of the puzzle put in place for you. And then to your point though, is like when things come along that are just out of your control and you're just waiting, it just adds to it, right? And then you just have to kind of, it is what it is. And, you know, you do what you can to kind of keep the process moving forward. So, you know, we've got the place demoed, we're ready to go. And now we just kind of, we just wait and we shop for other real estate in the meantime.
That's my favorite thing about you, Scott.
I'm a dick.
Don't worry, we bought another one. All right, where is it? Drayton.
Yeah, don't worry about that. Yeah. Drayton. That's our new adventure. Yes.
That's fine. All right. So we're going to move on. This show is we talk a lot about duplex on the show, and Scott is, he's not tooting his own horn here, but he's known as the duplex king of Welland. So Scott did five duplexes in a span of about a year and a half in Welland, I believe it was.
Yeah. Maybe a little less than that, I think. So we did four in 12 or four in maybe 10 or 11 months, and one was just before that, right?
Yeah.
So, but there was a point in time when, all the final four were kind of all in various stages of construction and, you know, marketing for tenants and all of that. So, it was fun because, you know, I could drive out to Welland and, you know, kind of be efficient and, you know, show a couple different units and check on another one, see how they're coming along. So they're all great properties now. They're all done. They're all rented. They're all cash flowing. Really awesome. So yeah, good properties.
Again, Scott lives in the GTA and he drives to Welland 3 days a week, 4 days a week to get tenant fillings done. He's a brave man.
Yeah. I live on the west end of the GTA. So I'm in Georgetown, right? So to get from Georgetown to Welland door to door to a property would be, I'll hop on the 407, like an hour and 15 minutes. Right. So it's not that bad.
You put a lot of miles on the car last year.
People commute further for work every single day back and forth than that. And but yes, I did throw a lot of miles on. So especially in that time when they were starting to become available, and I was always, so I'm always very keen on getting the properties ready to show before they're done. So,
oh, I'm well aware.
Yes, yeah, so I'll show up and they're still putting up, you know, they're sanding.
They're demoing the place. Hey, can I come show it this weekend?
not that early, but yeah, so I do like to go when it's still kind of rough and show what the vision's going to be, because, you know, I think that if you're going to find a good tenant, they need to give notice where they're currently moving from. So the best tenants are the ones that are shopping 60 days in advance for a new place, right? The worst ones are the ones that come to you and say, I like it, can I move in next week, kind of thing. So, and I've taken some of those too, just to be clear, but they're the best ones are the ones that are way more proactive and that are working with their landlord and giving proper notice before they move to the next one. So as a result, I like to start early because I don't want to have a property sitting there that's beautiful and shiny and clean and vacant for 3 months. Forget that. I want it filled as we're getting the final occupancy permits and all that. So
fair enough.
Yeah.
So this show is going to be about analyzing a duplex conversion from an investor standpoint. And obviously this is a renovation and contractor point of view, but I do want you to share your strategies and numbers. So my first question to you is, and I know it's changed a few times over the last few years, but your strategies especially when it comes to duplex conversions.
The strategy is the duplex conversion, first of all, right? Or secondary suites.
Sorry, what I meant by that was what I like to refer to is, like, are you going for cash flow? Are you going for the burr? Going for sale? And I know it's changed quite 2 times in the last 3 years, but
yeah.
I mean, I guess I'll tell the first part is, I know when we first met, you were after all the cash flow you can get so you can replace your income.
Yes. Absolutely.
And I believe in the last last 6 months, it switched to more of the burr model.
Yes. Yeah. Because I did, you're right. I was 100% focused, laser focused on cash flow, because I wanted to get to a point where I wouldn't be, relying on my T4 income from my employer forever. Right. So I had a great corporate career, 23 years in one industry, and then a few years prior to that in other industries, but, you know, rose the ladder, climbed the ladder, did well, you know, but when you're getting a good salary from an employer, you start to become very reliant on that salary, right? And so when you think about, how am I going to replace that? Well, I got to do it with cash flow. That's going to take a long time. So you start to then look at your spending and how can you rein things in a little bit, and how much cash do I actually need coming in to get me to where I want to be. And then, so I just kind of reverse engineered my strategy into, you know, I need X amount of dollars in order to live comfortably with, you know, with my family of four. So when we were shopping for properties that we could duplex, it was all around, what's the purchase price going to be? How much is going to cost me to renovate this thing? And most importantly, what can I collect in rent? And can I get the tenants to cover all of the utilities? Because that's going to help with my cash flow. Is there an extra garage I can rent on top of the units? Like, those are the kinds of things I would always be looking for, so that I can maximize cash flow. Now, to be honest, to be clear, I don't want you to get the impression that I'm gouging or, you know, overpricing units or anything like that. I'm not. I do tend to price my units at the top of the market, in order to attract the type of tenant profile that I'm looking for. But I think it's good value.
Let me interrupt there. Scott, just again, no one put that innuation in there, but Scott also renovates his place to the top of the market. So it justifies that he's not a slumlord by any means.
Thank you. Wow, that's a compliment.
That's the nicest thing I'll ever say about him, but it's true. The places were always renovated top notch.
Yeah, and I think that, so I, after doing one or two like that and having the opportunity to then show the units to prospects coming through, like, it's a delight, like, just to see what the tenants are seeing relative to other properties that they've walked through in their little, you know, hey, I'm looking for a new apartment, and maybe they are checking out a couple of, you know, slummy buildings or something that, you know, a unit that hasn't been renovated in 20 years. And it's got ugly parquet flooring and, you know, brown cabinets and really crappy countertops. I don't know, right? And then they walk into one of the units that we renovated, and, you know, it's all very modern, light gray and whites, pot lights, so very, very bright, and stainless appliances, laundry in the units. And it just, like, people see that and they're like, they just love it right away, right? Now, I will say that that's kind of That was my advantage when we first started doing them in Welland. But it got harder as time went on because I wasn't the only guy in town doing that anymore. So suddenly there were a lot of people that had nice units to show. So, and then it became more of a getting to know the other investors in Welland that are doing it. So we could share notes on, you know, hey, have you had these guys come take a look at your place yet? And what are you charging for rent? That kind of stuff. So,
yeah. So on that note, when Scott first started doing the duplexes, I think he was one of the first in the entire area. Cause when we were applying for permit on Scott's first place, the permit came in 3 business days. That doesn't happen anymore. But I remember right at the end of your first project, there's an article that came out in one of the Toronto newspapers about the gold mine that's available in Welland, and it changed. Now it's quite the popular investor market. So it was a lot easier back then to find the places too.
And now, of course, like the properties that we were quite happy to buy, you know, so the properties I bought in Welland were all, the price points were, the lowest was 320, the highest was 370. And they were all kind of similar type of, you know, 1950s, maybe some in the early 60s, brick bungalows, and, you know, 1,100 square feet on the main floor, good footprint in the basement with enough headroom. I was quite happy paying that price point, even though at the time you're like, oh my goodness, what am I paying $350 for? I specifically remember talking to a neighbor next door at one of the houses I just paid $345 for. And he was like, holy smokes, you paid $345 for this house? I bought the house next door for $180, he tells me. And of course, that was, you know, 5 years ago or something. So he was just stunned that the prices were, you know, I paid $345 for this one. And that's probably the biggest duplex I have. Like, it's like almost 1,500 square feet on the main level. But now, like, I've been I had some offers in, and they're all going well over 400 for properties that need a lot of work on the main level. Forget about the basement duplex or the basement suite. They need a full gut on the main floor as well, because it's, you know, grandma's house and, you know, might be an estate sale, and people are tripping over each other, putting offers in and paying over ask. So it's amazing how the market just continues to grow. And I mean, I think it's been an exceptional time period going through the last couple of months with COVID and how the market is just on fire right now. And it certainly applies in the Niagara region. So.
Yeah, Welland has gone up in value at least 75K in 2 years. So it's insane. Like, we're recording this to now, I think you can purchase homes in St. Catharines now cheaper than Welland. And 2 years ago, there was a $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 differential. So it's amazing what's happened there. But now I guess my next question to you is running your numbers on a duplex. And I guess I'm more going to ask you more on a renovation factor. But please share when you're analyzing your numbers, even when purchasing and rentals.
So your question is how I run my numbers?
Yeah, so how do you run your numbers? If you go to look at a property, you know the place is you're going to do a duplex conversion, you know you're going to renovate the main floor, but you got to, I guess it all depends on the strategy you're running to, but yeah. I guess start with your cash flow strategy and go from there.
Yeah, so I mean, like, I'm obviously looking at what the total dollars invested are going to be. So what's my down payment requirement? What's the renovation budget going to look like? And it's not just, when the renovation budget or quote comes in, you've got to start looking at, there's oftentimes things over and above, like, you know, you got to think about, oh, I'm going to need 2 sets of appliances in this place. I'm going to need to do something with the driveway. Maybe it needs to be widened. There's just little things like that you have to always put in your slush fund and to plan for that. But, you know, I just use like a good analysis spreadsheet that I got from a fellow investor actually in the Niagara region, Ian Pooland. He's a great cash flow analyzer. And I've just become very, very reliant on just going in, plugging in the numbers and looking at when I put in my purchase price, and then we're gonna go 20% down, and how much is the reno, and then we understand the closing costs, like the land transfer tax, the legal fees, et cetera, et cetera. What I wanna look at is what is the estimated appraised value gonna be on the back end, or the ARV? And when I know that, and so, because I've done a few of them now, I kind of got a feel for what it will be worth in Welland. Most people are seeing close to $500,000 now on a final legal duplex. Then you just can kind of work your numbers and realize, well, what what am I going to end up leaving in the deal, right? So, and in my experience, you're in Welland, you are leaving some money in the deal because the lift in value isn't significant enough after doing the duplex to be able to pull all your money out. Sometimes the people refer to that as the perfect burr. So you do end up leaving a chunk of cash in to the property. And I mean, as long as you know that going in, and that you don't want to be surprised by that at the end, right? Because if you're buying a property and thinking that you're going to put a $100,000 renovation in it, and you know, you put a $60,000 down payment in or whatever, and you think that after 4 months, you're going to get that whole chunk of coin back in your pocket, and you don't, well, then that can destroy you, right? So you have to know going in that I'm okay with leaving 70 grand in this property, for example. Like, and it's not going to be forever. It might be that I'm going to wait 2 years and I'm going to refi again because, you know, maybe the market's going to go up in value. Maybe I'm getting better rents and I'll make a stronger case now to the next time I do an appraisal. But I always say, you know, it's not like you only have one shot at the refi to get your value where you want it to be. You can refi multiple times. And I've done that on a few properties now, right? Where I've got a refi in, I'm like, yeah, it's not bad. I'll take it. I get some cash back from the lender. And then I do it again a year later, right? And then I get like, here comes another 50K kind of thing. So that's the way I've always looked at it. But the point I'm making is you got to know upfront what you're okay with leaving locked in that deal, because you can't assume you're going to get every dollar back out of it again. And if you need every dollar back out in order to continue growing, well, then, you know, you're going to have to find a different deal perhaps, or a different market where that will work. Right.
And that leads into my next question is markets. I know a couple of markets you work in. I know you started in the Hamilton market and moved your way onto the Welland market, but I guess my opinion is like the burr is going to work a lot better in a market like Hamilton or Brantford that's got more comps compared to Welland. But Welland, I know you were doing excellent with cash flow. So
that's right.
When you're analyzing your markets, talk about that.
Yeah. Well, so you're right. So like my mindset has shifted a little bit to more of now I'm less focused on, I mean, cash flow still is king to me. Like I still want to have every property I invest in needs to cash flow, have positive cash flow. If it doesn't, I will not touch it. But I'm not necessarily, my bar isn't the same as it once was, right? So before, when I'm looking at a duplex and I'm like, I need at least $800 a month cash flow in every one we do, and maybe 1,000 if we can push it. I'm okay with less now because I've kind of gotten to the point where I have enough cash flow coming in that's servicing the properties, providing income to me, so that I'm also now looking at more of a longer term, like more of a wealth play. So I want to grow the value over time. And, you know, when you're using the burr strategy and you're putting you're going for a higher financing or higher mortgage at the end of the project, well, that's going to hurt your cash flow, obviously, because your financing costs are higher. But as long as it still carries the cost of holding the property, then it's good, right? And because you're now looking at that as like maybe a 5-year term, and you're going to recycle that out after 5 years and maybe sell it or maybe refi it again or whatever options available at that time. And so, yeah, like markets like Hamilton, you're generally going to get bigger lifts in value in that market because there are tons of good comps out there, right? So people are selling their legal duplexes. I just did an appraisal on one of my duplexes that was done back in 2017 on the East Hamilton Mountain. I refied it 2 years ago. It refied at 510. I refied it 2 weeks ago and it came in at 630. So you can just see, like, it just keeps giving you the opportunity to go back and do it again and again and again. So Hamilton's growing like gangbusters, right? So it is easier to pull more and more of your cash out. Welland will get there, right? Because as more investors are doing the duplex conversion strategy in that market, what inevitably will happen is that there will be some people that will eventually start to sell them off, right? Which will create more comps in the market that the appraisers can look at when they come look at one of our finished properties. Because I'll tell you, like, I had a very disappointing appraisal in, I think it was February, in Welland, where the appraiser looked at the property. It was a legal duplex. I walked him through it. I brought the package of information. I had all my comps that I was armed with. I brought all of the invoices for all the work that we did. you know, showing how much money we invested in making this place legal and safe and amazing. I showed him leases to show how much rent we're getting, which was like really, really good rents. And then he came back, you know, 2 days later and said, well, here's your value. And it was like 435. And I thought for sure it would be 500 easily. Like, this was in 2020. And he proceeded to tell me why he appraised it at 435. And it was because the comps that he used were all just like single family homes that haven't been, and they were all a little bit, you know, let's say renovated in the 80s and 90s. So it has so much to do with like what the comps are on the market, but a lot also to do with the appraiser himself.
Yeah.
So you, in those situations, you can certainly go to the lender and say, you know what, send me a different appraiser. I want to try that over again. And I've done that before too. In this case, I didn't. I was kind of running out of time for various things. I just said, fine, I'll take it. And I moved on, and I just added a HELOC to that property, knowing that I'll probably just go back and do it again in a matter of time.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah.
That was a lot of information in a short period of time. So all right. So now we get into
My mind is full of things, all things Welland right now. But anyways, yeah.
So back into my realm. So when you're wanting to walk a property for your interesting thing, what factors and what goes to your mind and running your analysis on deciding the extent of the renovations? Normally a duplex conversion, you're going to have to do the whole basement. We have an approximate cost for that. When you're analyzing like main floors or you're going to do exterior work, what's going through your head on that?
So, I mean, the first things I look at on a property are always like the big ticket items, right? So before we start figuring out if it's going to be, are we going to duplex this? We look, you know, is the roof reasonable or is it going to need to be done in the next 2 or 3 years? What are the mechanicals like? Is the air conditioning unit, you know, more than 5 years old? What about the furnace? Electrical, like, is it already updated, or, you know, is it knob and tube, or is it like aluminum wiring or whatever, right? So like understanding kind of the big ticket items. And then, of course, insurance always wants to know, is there galvanized plumbing in the place? Cause we've got to rip all that out. But then like, once that's out of the way, you know, if you're thinking about, is this going to work for a good multifamily situation, like two families under one roof? I'll tell you the one thing that I always look for now is that the separate entrance to the basement. I have some properties where the entrance is at the back of the house, and I have some properties where the entrance is at the side of the house.
Scott is not a fan of the back door entrance.
I am not a fan of the back of the house entrance for the lower unit. For a lot of reasons.
Yeah, now, I agree.
You know why, right? Like, number one, it's a lot more snow that the poor basement tenant has to now shovel a path through, you know, some type of a little walkway that we've given them, or maybe it's across a yard or whatever. So it's not as ideal. I mean, it works. But the other thing is, I have one property, actually two, where it's where the doors are the back of the house, and the tenants have to walk right past like a nice big living room window to get to their door, right? So the living room window from the upper unit. So your basement tenants are always kind of walking around. And I just feel like there's a lack of privacy in these situations, right? So when I look at a potential duplex, if the door is at the back of the property, sometimes it's kind of tucked aside the garage at the back, where then it's okay. But if it's one of these ones that's dead center of the bungalow, but in the backyard, they got to walk past windows, a bathroom window, a bedroom window. Ugh, I don't like that. I mean, it's not a showstopper for me, but it's not my favorite. I love having the door right off the driveway. Right.
Yeah. I mean, we've also had, you know, friends in the area do them in the area, and they end up splitting the backyard with a fence, so they get the privacy with their back door entrances and stuff like that. And, you know, security lighting and stuff like that. So it's not the end of the world when you have the back door.
No, entry. It's not. It's just a consideration. It's
definitely more ideal when you have the side door entrance. Yeah.
So there's that. And then, of course, then the other thing is right away, like, you're looking at what's the basement look like. You know, I love when you go to, you're checking out like a few different properties. If you're shopping with a couple of different investors, you'll always know you're with investors because people walk in the house and they ignore the main floor. They go right in the basement, right? They're like, everybody's checking out the ceiling heights. Where are the ducts running? Is there any beam we have to worry about? The ceiling height really matters a lot, but really paying attention to the ceiling height going down the stairwell. You know, I've got one where it's a little bit tight going through the stairwell. It's still passed all the permits, but it's just a little bit uncomfortable, right? If you were like 6'1", going down the stairs, you'd whack your head, for example, which makes it a problem for bringing in bigger pieces of furniture and blah, 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 right? And I guess the other thing that I like to look for is the windows that are down there. So is there an opportunity to have lots of natural light? So I love properties that have the windows that are above grade already versus having to have a whole thing in the window well, right? You can do it. You can always add the big windows by putting a window well in. It's nicer though when you don't have that.
Yeah, no. Yeah. They call those raised bungalows, and they're rare, but man, do they make beautiful basement suites.
Yeah.
Make beautiful basement suites. And I mean, one of your last properties that you did there, I remember we actually relocated whole furnaces to the other side of the house to make sure we have nice head house and put beams in. And tell you the honest truth, on the scope of a project and expense, it was actually very minimal.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't scare me away too much. But I mean, for a quick rule of thumb, you want to see a minimum of 6'5" head clearance at the lowest point. You want about an average of 6'11". Now that depends on the city, because in like the city of Hamilton, for example, 6'1" is the minimum. They go off the National Building Code, but that's where kind of your contractor team, your designer team, that's not really your investor shove to know. But when you're analyzing a property, that's a good thing to do. Now, Scott's going and saying all that stuff, and I don't think the last three houses he even saw before closing date, so let's not let him bull every too much. But that's where you need a power team, and they call it in this industry.
Yeah, that's true. I did get into the habit of, let's see, did we see them? So we bought them. A lot of times we bought firm. No, it was firm financing, but we had a walkthrough inspection condition in there, and that would be the first time that I would sometimes see it. So the realtor would walk through. Sometimes we'd do a FaceTime call, like, you know, you were on FaceTime, I was on FaceTime, realtor's on FaceTime, we're walking through the property, and we'll say, yeah, let's throw in the offer right now, and we'll say, hey, we'll waive our condition in 24 hours if we can do a walkthrough tomorrow. And that's when we just do the final check on can we make this thing do flexible and then firm up quickly. So,
but on a serious note, I mean, the way the real estate market's been, that's how you're going to get ahead. You're going to need a team, because I mean, if you would have waited 3-4 days, more than likely those properties weren't going to be available. So
yeah,
it's a weird.
Well, today, if I was putting an offer in right now on one in Welland or Hamilton for that matter, like there's no way I could put a condition in for an inspection. You'd have to do the inspection in advance. And for me, that's just like, let's go walk through it. Like you and I can go walk through the property. I'm putting an offer in tonight, but I want to see it. I want to walk through it right now and catch anything that looked like red flags so that I can go in confident with my offer.
So when you, when you're looking at a main floor for your extensive rentals, cause this is where I laugh. The first property you did there in Welland, renovated to the nines, but left the ugliest kitchen in world history. But I mean, obviously it didn't really affect your rent any, it didn't affect your anything, and it worked. I didn't agree with it whatsoever, but it worked, and you end up getting a nice family that's been there long term. So, but when you're going in there, how are you making those decisions?
Yeah. I feel like I do fall into the trap now of over renovating a little bit. It's a balance, right? So I do like to provide a nice upper unit as well. So like the last few were new kitchens upstairs, and kitchen's not that much money, right? When you do a decent IKEA kitchen in there, it's not a ton of money. So I don't know, what is it on average? Like $8,000 maybe, something like that?
$6,000 to $8,000 depending on the size. Yeah.
But now the only thing is then you got to add in your appliances. So then you get some extra expense with that.
Yeah.
So we have done that in the last few. Paint, floors, most of the time we will want to do floors in there. A lot of times I just want to do floors because they're so damn squeaky, the original hardwood. So
Scott's got a squeak obsession, but yes. So, but yeah, I think one of your properties you left the hardwood.
That was the last one we did actually. Yeah. It's hardwood, but it wasn't as squeaky as some of the other ones we've had. And so
during the investigation meeting, when the realtors walked to walk over there, don't talk, I want to listen. Walk over there, don't talk, I want to listen. But yeah, no, it's,
yeah,
I got you. So you know what, it's for tenant comfort, it's important, because you got these people walking up and down all day long, and you don't want to hear that from the basement. So
exactly. Yeah. You know what's surprising to me though is I always hear people say that the number one complaint you get when having a duplex is noise issues between upper and lower. Knock on wood, I have never had one complaint about noise. Not one.
Yeah, you know what though, on your project, you've done slightly above the minimum code, because we need a minimum code of a sound rating of 50.
Yeah.
When you, by the time you screw down those floors and you add that vinyl flooring, it's above 50. So that's probably why you're ahead of the game. But yes, it's always an issue and it's always a battle. And the problem is there's no real way to make it perfect.
Because of the ductwork.
Because of ductwork. Now you can rip the ductwork out, but I mean, this is where soundproofing alone, you could spend 30, 50 grand on. And obviously, I mean, there's a bunch of techniques, and there's some guys that do what I do that, you know, that have a sound thing, and that they attack it, but it's quite costly. So, but
like the doubling up on the drywall and all
double
that.
Double up on drywall. There's special wraps. There's special underpads. There's
green glue. Stuff
called green glue.
Yeah.
But I mean, for example, that, a gallon of that green glue is like $700, and you know, so you got to do the whole ceiling. So it's a constant battle, but,
Because I think if you're going to do that, like invest like in the really robust ceiling separation with two layers and all that, then I would be thinking, well, maybe we should just like separate the heating system while we're at it.
Exactly. I mean, that's the problem is like renovations, I deal with it daily basis. It's like it can snowball.
Yeah.
You do one thing, it affects the other. So, I mean, especially on investment on an REI show or an REI renovation, it is tough to draw the line, but you got to draw the line.
I'll tell you my little tip though on this too is this is not a renovation thing. This is just how you, it's expectation setting, right? So when I'm putting, as I do fill my own units, I find my own tenants. I always am careful around, you know, I tend not to put a larger families in the upstairs. So if they have like three young kids, I'm generally going to see if I can get them in a basement unit, because I don't want like, you know, little footsteps ripping up and down the hallway and annoying the downstairs people. So that's one thing. But the second thing is I always just make sure I have that conversation while they are looking at the place. Like just being honest with you guys, like this is there are two families living under one roof here. You're going to hear each other, right? And you're probably going to get to know each other. You're going to bump into each other in the driveways. So, you know, you have to be comfortable with that. And so I'm just letting them know that they're going to, it's not perfect, right? We do it to code. We make it safe. But it's never going to be perfect. And I don't know, I think that sometimes helps, right? So getting them started on the right foot that when they get in there and, you know, maybe they're coming from a place that there was no sound separation, right? And so maybe this is a massive upgrade when they get into a duplex like this. So, yeah.
Yeah, so it's setting expectations is a good term, and as from a contractor's point of view, setting expectations with your customer investor is also another thing, which leads me into my last topic for today, and this is an interesting one, and it's about contractors. Now, full disclosure, Scott and I work together, but Scott's also got some horror stories. So we're going to just have a quick chat about that. How I met Scott was through a realtor investor. He bought a house in Welland, and he texted me, and I texted him back, and he was shocked by this, and I thought that was kind of confusing. I was like, you asked me to do work. I do work. So why don't you just do a quick little prelude of what's your experience with contractors, good, bad, and the ugly?
Let's see. Well, I worked with a few contractors. So even like one of my early days investing, which it was only 6 years ago, but on the east side of the city of Toronto, where I was investing in Bowmanville, Oshawa. You know, there were some experiences where I was trying to find help on various trades, or I was basically sourcing help on my own. I was not
working. Acting as your own general.
Yeah. And I did learn that it seemed to be a consistent element with the trades that I was working with, that they're not great at following up. They're not great at communicating. They're not great at even being keeping the promises, right? When they said I'm gonna okay, fine, let's do it on Tuesday, and then nothing happens. Like, so that was kind of, that set my expectations pretty early that this is not as easy as I hoped it would be. Fast forward a few years, I'm working with working on a duplex that I have in Hamilton, and I needed to do some. This was an illegal duplex I had, and I was trying to do a few things, like put laundry in one unit and do do a little bit of separation or things. Anyways, working with a contractor, and it was just, it was painful, right? Because I was trying to get things accomplished, and like this contractor was going completely dark on me for like weeks at a time. Where I'm like, this, I'm paying you. Like, I need you to respond. I need you to you know, to get done what you said you would do. And you kind of, as an investor, you get to this point where you feel like, I should just cut bait right now and go somewhere else. But here's the problem. I'm already 4 weeks down this rabbit hole with this one person that's taken me thus far. I kind of get this feeling that I got to see it through now, right? I got to get them to finish what they promised, because, you know, maybe there were, could have been a deposit paid. Maybe the work was half done. I can't remember all the exact situation now. But anyways, long story short, this particular one went sideways on me. I did end up cutting it off because this is not working. I changed the scope of the project, ended up in a situation where I overpaid. We finally had a conversation, agreed on what the overpayment amount was. And, you know, he said, yeah, no problem. I'll give you that money back to you. Sorry, whatever. It's coming back to you. Except here's what happens. That money never comes back to me, right? And now it's been over 2.5 years, something like that. No money, didn't come back to me. And, you know, contractor's gone. He basically ghosted me. So
this is just the fun part here about this whole conversation. I had to bring this up. Tell them what you do every 30th of the month, Scott.
Every 30th of the month. It's actually the first of the month. But so I'm pretty organized. So I do all my accounting. And actually, my wife does the bookkeeping and QuickBooks Online. And every first of the month, that contractor gets an invoice from me it's a receivable. So out it goes, and it always adds one more month of interest. So just keeps on accumulating. And here's the funny part. I don't know if I ever told you this, but I was like, I've never had to do this before. So I'm like, how much interest do you charge somebody on an overdue account? So you know what I did? I just looked at his invoices to me, and I used the exact verbiage from his invoice and the exact percentage. And I just popped that on my invoice and said, you owe me the same. It's like 2.2% or 2% a month or something crazy, right? 24% per annum. And it's growing nicely. So at some point I'll get a judgment, and then, you know, get a ticket to collections. I don't know. We'll see. For now, it's just fun.
I die because I get the update every month. Oh, it's invoice time. So here's my opinion on that. What Scott went through on there, when he felt like he should have cut it off, he should have cut it off. Tell you the honest truth, I say this all the time. Contracting business is the worst business on average in this country, in this world, in my opinion. The problem is, it takes nothing to become a contractor. The honest truth of the matter is I was an electrical contractor. The next day I decided I'm a general contractor. And even I don't think that's right. I think that's completely wrong. But if you're having a terrible experience with your contractor, or you just don't get along, it might not even be the contractor's fault. My opinion is, if at early stages, it should be cut off, because look what he's dealt with now, 2.5 years later, he's still finding problems at the same property. And that's my opinion. That should have been cut off a long time ago. Being a good contractor takes a lot. There is a million moving pieces, which I'll talk about in another video. But sometimes it's just best for us as a customer, as a consumer, as an investor to, if it's not working between you, end it.
Yeah. And I, what you said before is how, the first project that we worked together on, I got your number. I sent you a quick text, and then you respond like literally within like 2 minutes or something. And I was like, oh, I like this style. Right.
Because it's just strange, right?
I was like, well, this guy, he knows how to communicate. Interesting. And I thought, well, then again, maybe it's just because I'm not a customer yet. And he's just like trying to like win me over here. But that's been pretty good. So John's pretty on the ball on the communication. I will say though, to me as a, and this you have to remember, I was working full time and trying to manage things. And so it's the most important thing, I think, to the investor, is to have a contractor that is always in touch with you. When you reach out to your contractor, if you're not hearing back for a day, it starts to become a problem. But if it's a week like I'm losing it at this point. And like I'm busy at work. I'm between meetings, and I got like a little window. I'm running into a conference room. I'm like trying to call the contractor. I'm like, dude, like I need an update on these things, and I can't. I'm leaving voicemails. I'm getting nowhere. It just drives you nuts. You're pulling your hair out, right? So that's why communication to me is probably more important than anything. Beyond that, provide me a good estimate and then stick to the timeline, then I'm happy.
Yeah. I mean, it's a constant battle. There's always issues, but I study quite a bit of contractor education and books, but there's a very famous guy from the States who says, as a construction guy, you should answer all your phone calls that day or at latest by 9 o'clock the next morning. So these people aren't waiting. Now this guy is an old school guy too, between emails, texts and things. This is why as a company, you try to improve your communication skills. We even get softwares involved and stuff like that. But, you know, I think if you're going to work with someone, you're going to hand them that kind of, you're that kind of dough, and you're going to put that kind of responsibility, and you got to have a good relationship. Now, I'm more of a phone person myself. Scott's a texter. Point where he'll text me 17 times in a row and I just get fed up and call him. It's like,
that's okay. I'll take it.
Past two texts. This is a conversation now, but I think
like the paper trail though. I like the paper trail.
Yeah, that's it. I try to avoid that. No. But I think whoever you're working with, wherever you are, you know, if your contractor is not responding to you within 24 hours, start getting alarmed. If he's, you know, if you're not here in 3-7 days, yeah, that's where you probably need to end that. And I mean, on anything, if you didn't respond to your boss in 24 hours, I don't think that would go for you well either, right? Oh. So, I mean, it's just...
It's common sense. And it's like, I mean, I work in like sales kinds of jobs, business development jobs in the past as well. And I would always tell people that worked with me was like when I was training somebody new on the team, if you get an email from a customer, and if you don't have the answer right now, at least acknowledge the respond to their email saying, got it, I'm looking into it, send, right? Just so the customer on the other end of it knows that the email just didn't go into some black hole and is being ignored, right? That alone is that simple little trick just puts people's minds at ease, right? So I got it, don't worry, I'll get back to you in like a couple of days or something like that. I'm like, okay, cool. I know at least he's acknowledged it.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. Well, this has been a longer episode than I expected, but I could talk to Scott for hours because I think he's already got 3 hours of my time today. So, but in all honesty, thanks, Scott, for being on. It's been a lot of fun. I'll have you on again, I'm sure. But it's officially 9 o'clock at night now. I've been up since like 3. I'm going to bed now. So
yeah,
I really appreciate you coming on. If we got any questions, so I'll post we'll get the show notes posted on the thing. I'll put Scott's contact. If you got any questions, he's a wealth of knowledge and he's actually really good for younger investors to teach. And he's really willing to share his knowledge. He's a great guy. So,
I'm also pretty young, by the way. Don't imply that I'm an old guy.
Well, would you turn 63 this year? I don't know.
Not a millennial, let's put it that way.
No, I've never said this because I was pissed off about it, but congratulations on the retirement.
Thank you.
Except for now, he's not waking up to 9 o'clock in the morning, but
I don't consider it retirement. I consider it just the next chapter, right? So right. I'm focusing on other things that are, you know, that are more my passion now. So
yeah, right on. Well, it's been fun, and we'll talk. I'm sure I'll be speaking to you in the morning. So, thanks.
All right.
Thanks for having us being on, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me.
Bye, guys.